Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point.
Chuck and Nancy, they don't want the wall. They want open borders. They're more interested in taking care of criminals than they are in taking care of you.
President Trump at a campaign rally last night in Nashville, Tennessee. He again blamed Democrats for MS-13, gang violence, and illegal immigration. It's all against the backdrop of his zero-tolerance crackdown on migrant families being separated at the border and headlines about lost migrant children. Trump also promised the border wall was coming soon and Mexico would pay for it. This hour on Point, the administration's new immigration strategy. And where are those missing 1,500 migrant children? You can join us on air or online. Is separating migrant families the right thing to do? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll discuss the fury and fallout over Roseanne Barr. But first, what's happening at the southern border? Joining me first from Miami, Florida, is Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today. You can find a link to his latest story. Trump blames Democrats for how his administration handles separated immigrant children. That's at our website, onpointradio.org. Alan Gomez, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
So there's the president at the rally in Nashville last night talking about immigration. He argued for stricter border policies. He accused Democrats of siding with brutal immigrant gang members over American citizens. He says MS-13 gang members are not human.
This is why we call the bloodthirsty MS-13 gang members exactly the name that I used last week. What was the name?
Animals.
Alan Gomez, what did you hear in President Trump's message last night?
I mean, pretty much a continuation of what we've been hearing since day one of his presidential campaign, when he descended that escalator and talked about Mexico not sending us their best or their brightest. It's really, you know, we see this from time to time where, you know, he'll kind of forget about immigration for a little bit and then he kind of jumps back into it. And in this case, there was a lot of pushback when he used that phrase. It wasn't entirely clear the first time around that he was only referring to MS-13 gang members. He's since clarified that that's what he meant. And in that case, I don't think he's going to get any disagreement around the country that these folks are. This is one of the worst, most violent gangs that we have operating in this country. But the problem now is what to do about it. And that's where he continues to have an incredibly difficult time trying to figure out how to work with Congress to forge a compromise, to find a way to get some of the things that he wants, but also get, you know, but also appease Democrats to get some of what they want. Mm.
This comes in the midst of President Trump's zero tolerance crackdown on families who cross the border illegally. In light of that, there's been a 21% increase in the number of migrant children held in U.S. government custody without their parents just in the last month. Put that number into context for us, Alan. What's the difference now with the Trump administration when it comes to children crossing the border?
And this is a very important point to get to, I think, because he's one of the things he's also doing is blaming Democrats, and not just him. The White House held a call with reporters yesterday where his senior advisor Stephen Miller was on there and members of Homeland Security and Justice, and they were trying to pin the blame on Democrats for all the laws, basically, that we have that govern how the U.S. treats unaccompanied minors, how they treat minors in custody. And just to be very clear on that point, that's not the case. Republicans, the Supreme Court, Republican presidents, Republican Congresses have passed a series of laws and settled a series of court cases that have put us in this position that require the U.S. to minimize the amount of time that minors are in detention and require them to go through certain steps when they're repatriating or deporting them back to their home countries. What the Trump administration has done is changed the policy where before deportations were traditionally treated as a civil offense. So you went through a civil deportation process. What this zero tolerance policy means is that everybody who illegally crosses a border will be prosecuted criminally. And that then forces them to separate the families. So it's important to make that distinction.
So here is Attorney General Jeff Sessions speaking in San Diego earlier this month, talking about this policy, announcing the Justice Department would begin prosecuting everyone who enters the U.S. illegally.
If you cross the border unlawfully, then we will prosecute you. It's that simple. If you smuggle illegal aliens across our border, then we will prosecute you. If you are smuggling a child, then we will prosecute you. And that child may be separated from you as required by law.
And here he is continuing with a defense of the administration's child separation policy.
If you don't want your child to be separated, then don't bring them across the border illegally. It's not our fault that somebody does that.
So are these illegal immigrants? These are asylum seekers. This is anyone who crosses the border. Is that right, Alan?
And that's where it's become, it's become both, where it's one thing to say if you cross a border illegally, we're going to separate you. And that's been happening, we believe, more and more. We're still waiting for the Department of Homeland Security to provide us some data to really show what's going on. But the there's a lawsuit right now in California over the fact that people who have presented themselves for asylum, in other words, they're doing this the legal way. They'll come in. They pass the initial screening, which is referred to as a credible fear determination. And so there's a, you know, a starting belief that they might have a claim to make. They're still having their children separated from them in some cases. And again, there's a lawsuit in California pending on that we're waiting on. And so, yeah, it's not just folks coming over here legally. It's some folks apparently who are coming here legally. And then you see the administration trying to ramp up their efforts to build more family detention centers to, and again, change the laws so that minors can be held in custody for longer and families can be jailed for longer periods of time together.
So this zero tolerance policy is one of several intersecting, overlapping immigration stories at this moment. Over the last few days, we've heard about these quote unquote missing almost 1,500 children, immigrant children. Who are these kids?
So the process right now, how it works, is if you come over and you are an unaccompanied, and you're a minor, and you come over illegally, at some point now more likely you're going to be separated from your parents, and then the Department of Homeland Security has to hand them over to the Department of Health and Human Services to take care of them. And one of the things that they do predominantly is try to place them with sponsor families. For the most part, they try to find relatives of theirs that are in the country, if not their parents, and they place them there. At that point, HHS is sort of no longer legally responsible. But where that number came from is that HHS, as they put it, out of an abundance of caution, just made a phone call to all these thousands of sponsor families just to check in on these kids, see where they were. As they put it, they made one phone call to these homes, and in close to 1,500 cases, nobody picked up the phone. So HHS fights back against the idea that these children are lost, that they're all in danger. They say, hey, we made one phone call, nobody picked up. That, you know, in many cases, these families have an undocumented immigrant living in that home, so...
And don't want to be contacted by the government.
Right, yeah, right. They see a number coming from 202 from Washington. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily want to pick up that call. You know, maybe they just weren't home at the time of the call. A lot of, you know, polling data has shown over the years that minority families are more likely to have cell phones and landlines, mm-hmm. so there's a lot of problems with that methodology, let's say. But yeah, there are close to 1,500 that the federal government doesn't necessarily know where they are, but they also don't have a legal requirement to know where they are. So it's a mixed bag.
I see. Stick with me 1 minute, Alan. Let me bring another voice in here for insight into what this looks like on the ground. I want to speak with Alex Messing. He joins me from San Francisco, California, where he's working for the immigrant rights group Pueblo Sin Frentos. Alex Messing, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So tell me what you're seeing on the ground with regard to children crossing the border, either alone or with their families.
Well, I mean, kind of touching on some of the points that Alan made, I think, unfortunately, Sessions right now doesn't really distinguish too much between how somebody crossed, if you crossed at a port of entry, if you crossed illegally. What the administration is doing is looking for some sort of pretext that their fearful anti-immigrant base will believe in order to separate them from their kids. And so we're seeing arriving aliens separated from their children. There's a woman, Maria, who came on the caravan, whose two children were taken from her. They're 2 years old and 7 years old when they actually took them away. The officer had to ask Marie if the two-year-old knew how to walk yet, because he's so small.
And she was seeking asylum in this case.
She was seeking asylum. She made that very clear. She had the original birth certificates, and she had the her own government-issued ID. She had a sworn declaration that these were her kids. And they were taken from her anyway. And there are also people who have been all of the people who have been forced to have their kids taken from them because of the criminalization of immigrants. And so I think that the zero tolerance policy that we talk about, what's being seen on the ground, is that that's effectively a zero tolerance for immigrants. A zero tolerance in general, anybody who crosses is automatically having their kids taken from them if they cross.
So in the past, children were linked to their parents' immigration proceedings, and now they're physically and legally separated from their parents. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, not every single parent is separated from their children, but in the case of prosecutions, if they're being charged, if they're being accused by the Department of Justice of committing a crime, which is this zero tolerance thing that, that Sessions has, then they're all being taken away. And with those rising numbers of children in child facilities, they're going to have to the places that they have to put children are getting full. And so there's
That's what I was going to ask you. How is this impacting resources on the ground? How's the system handling these cases? You're right in the middle of it.
Well, there's the prosecutions that are filling up courtrooms, and prosecutors and defenders alike are kind of have their eyebrows raised, waiting to see what happens as the numbers surpass capacity. And then you also have people who work at the shelters talking about how they're not going to have much room for them anyway. So this is an untenable policy aside from being completely cruel and inhumane.
We are discussing the Trump administration's new zero-tolerance immigration policy this hour, and you can join the conversation should anyone who approaches the border illegally be prosecuted. Is the government responsible for tracking children who are placed with sponsors? I'm Jane Clayson. More after this break, including your calls. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
How much would you pay to avoid morning traffic? Why are plane tickets to Boise so expensive? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of The Indicator. In every episode, we take on a new, unexpected idea to help you make sense of the day's news. Listen every afternoon on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about the president's new immigration policy that separates children and families. And you can join the conversation. What should the government do to fix immigration? Has the 1,500 missing migrant children story been blown out of proportion? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. I'm speaking this hour with Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today, and Alex Mensing of Pueblo Sin Fronteras. They're in San Francisco. Let me play these clips. This is an interview with NPR a few weeks ago. White House Chief of Staff John Kelly defended the administration's policy when asked if it's cruel to take a mother from her child.
The children will be taken care of. They'll put into foster care or whatever. But the big point is they elected to come illegally into the United States. And this is a technique that no one hopes will be used extensively or for very long.
And then Silvana Bermudez and her three children sought asylum in the United States in 2017 to escape a gang that had tried to kill her teenage son in El Salvador. Her kids were taken from her at a Border Patrol facility in Arizona, and she recounts here the scene by phone from a federal jail. This is a video produced by The Washington Post. The officer approached me. She says, "No, you can't go with your kids." I said, "Why not?" A social worker is coming and will take your kids. She says, "But my kids can't be alone." My little girl was crying. She only said, "Bye, mommy." So, Alex Mensing, speak a little bit about the deterrence of these policies, because, you know, there are many who say there are a lot of people crossing the border. We got to do something about this. And this is a policy that will deter immigration, illegal immigration, and some asylum seekers who need to go maybe someplace else. What do you say to them, Alex?
I think, you know, that's a really important thing to talk about in terms of whether or not people will come. I'm just going to the woman who I was talking about earlier, Maria, actually wrote a letter to us about what had happened. And there's a really important phrase in there where she says, I know I exposed them, but I know they are alive. If I'd stayed in El Salvador, maybe I wouldn't be here anymore, and maybe they wouldn't be here anymore. And she's talking about her kids there. So she had no choice other than to leave. And as far as people, I mean, she crossed at a port of entry, but there are people who do cross illegally. And there are people who cross illegally because they aren't let in, because Customs and Border Protection agents at the border tell them that they have no right to seek asylum. This is something that there's a lawsuit out about right now, accusing the federal government of turning people away. I have accompanied people to ports of entry and seen them turned away with my own eyes many times over the course of the last couple of years. And so deterring people by taking away their children and saying that you should have come in through the door when the door is shut and they're being turned away by U.S. government agents, I think points to what's really going on here, which is just a complete sealing off of the border and a terrorizing of immigrant families, and especially asylum seeking families. This is problematic because what they would have to go back to and what they're being asked to choose to stay in is even worse. I mean, if this worked as a deterrent, we would basically have to make the idea of what we're going to do to you when you get to the U.S. Mm-hmm. worse than what you're facing at home, which in many cases is direct death threats, torture, family members who have been murdered, extreme domestic violence. There are many, many reasons that people flee Central America and different parts of the world.
Here. Yeah. Let me bring another voice into the conversation at this point, Alex. Jessica Vaughn is with me in the studio. She's director of Policy Studies at the Center for Immigration Studies. Jessica, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks. Glad to be with you.
So you hear Alex there saying this policy is not a deterrent. The U.S. government is terrorizing immigrant-seeking families, asylum-seeking families. Do you see President Trump's zero-tolerance policies as a step in the right direction?
I do, most definitely. I mean, this problem has been festering since about 2012 with an influx of families and unaccompanied minors crossing the border illegally from Central America. The reason they're coming is because they've been told that if they make it to the United States, more than likely they will be allowed into the country, resettled either to join family members or friends who came before them, and allowed to work and be here indefinitely. And that if they skip out on their asylum hearings, as a very large percentage do, or they don't even file their asylum applications, because it's basically they're coached in advance for what to say, whether or not they intend to follow through on it, then they will be allowed to stay there and there will be no consequences for them. And until we change the way we handle these cases, they're going to keep getting this message and keep trying.
I guess the question is this the right approach? Is separating children and parents the right thing to do? Are we getting at the end game in the right way?
Well, unfortunately, mainly the courts, but also Congress's failure to address this problem have left the Trump administration with very few choices. I mean, I'm sure that the administration, like the Obama administration before it, would much rather keep family members together while their cases are processed. Mm-hmm. The problem is that in 2015, there was a lawsuit brought by some of the very same people who tend to criticize what's going on now, saying that the government cannot keep minors in detention at all, even if their parents are left. And at the time, the Obama administration said, look, this is going to lead to the separation of kids from their parents. But the judge persisted and enjoined this policy nationwide. And, until we can find a way around that, this is what has to happen.
Let me get a caller in here, Tito in Boston. I'm glad you called. Welcome to the program, Tito.
Hello, Jane.
Hi.
I have an opinion on terms of the detention of children. Mm-hmm. I would think it's a very clear violation of human rights, and I think that it should be brought to United Nations, make a case against this administration for violating the human rights of those children. And also, I have a question for the panelists. It recently, most of the, it's a caravan that was crossing from Mexico to the United States. Most of the people come from Honduras. Honduras just had a fraudulent election in November 26, 2017, and the United States recognized a government that is really responsible for the misery of those children and their parents. It has to leave Honduras because there's no way, no security for their life.
It was unsustainable there, that's for sure. Tito, thank you so much for the call. Jessica, you hear Tito there? We have a lot of listeners going to our website saying, one says, I believe forced separation of small children from their parents is so traumatic that it should be considered a crime against humanity. For a government entity to enforce such a procedure is about as low in morality as one can get. Tito says this is a violation of human rights. Your response?
Well, let's remember there are lots of different cases that are in this mix of people who are encountered by the government when they cross illegally. Sometimes it's the parents who paid the smuggler to bring the child across. There are parents who rent their children to other people who want to cross illegally, hoping that they will get off easier if they come with kids. And there are parents who are choosing to bring their children across illegally. And I think that's a terrible decision. And I think it's wrong for us to have policies that encourage people to do this.
Alex Mensing, what's your response? You know, you hear Jessica here, the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, says if you don't want to be separated from your child, don't come to the border illegally.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd go back to what I said before in terms of if the U.S. government actually let people in, if they didn't detain them indefinitely. I mean, a lot of Jessica's points, While they appear to make sense, I mean, they also assume that parents have to be locked up, right? We're going to have to separate your kids because your parents have to be in jail. Well, ICE's own policy says that an arriving alien or an asylum seeker who gets a credible fear, a positive determination, so they're likely to have a shot at winning an asylum case. That person, if they're not a flight risk, if they're not a security risk, they should be released. And rather than having dozens and dozens of private prisons where we detain immigrants for a very, very large cost every day, which is going into the coffers of private prison companies, why don't we have some sort of way of letting them seek asylum, letting them go through their court hearings, letting them do those things, not in detention. And I think that if there were a recognition of the refugee crisis in Central America, then maybe there wouldn't be so many judges denying asylum cases where sometimes I've actually heard and read decisions where a judge will say, I recognize that you will very probably be harmed when you go back, but not for a reason that a judge already said you would be. So tough luck.
Let me get Blanche in here, Alex. I got to go to a caller in Dayton, Ohio. Hi, Blanche. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My problem is that I'm looking at the world from the perspective of someone that grew up in America, born here, and I have a birth certificate here, and so do my children. Who is supposed to fix these countries? You leave and leave your parents, maybe your uncles, cousins, aunts, or whatever, in the situation to go to America to seek a better life. But who is responsible for what you've left behind? And I don't think that we have an obligation because other people are having a hard time there or this, that. We've got a lot of hurt going on in our own country. And in the meantime, we have our school children out there marching, and our legislators are all involved with children that have birth certificates and home country.
You're saying we can't fix everybody's problems. We got our own issues. Blanche, I hear your point. Thank you for calling. Let's get Barbara in here from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Barbara. You're on.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I really feel that the Trump administration is compounding the problem of illegals on the border. By cutting out foreign aid, we are increasing the problems in their home countries. The crime, the poverty. I really think that we need to increase foreign aid to these countries.
Blanche, Barbara, thank you very much. Alan Gomez, jump back in here. Is that part of the issue here? We're cutting foreign aid. We're sort of perpetuating or promoting these immigrants coming to our borders?
Yeah, and it's a really good point to raise because, you know, I hear both sides of it all the time right now. It's when it comes to these folks coming up from Central America, when we talk about refugees coming from the Middle East and Africa, that sentiment of how is your country ever going to recover if all of you are trying to come to the United States. But specifically when we talk about Central America, you know, those countries will tell you, hey, the U.S. has had a pretty long history of involvement in our countries and not always in the most beneficial way. So there's some responsibility to bear there. We've seen our foreign aid be cut under President Trump, under this administration, to those countries specifically. And when you look at when you consider the fact that the drug cartels that are overwhelming these countries, that are driving these incredible murder rates in those countries, those drugs aren't stopping in those countries. Those drugs are all coming up to the United States. So there's a pretty broad sentiment throughout that region and for many people in the United States that we do have a level of responsibility to help them improve their security and improve their economies and get them to the point that people aren't so fearful that they have to leave those countries and come to the United States.
Jessica, is that part of the solution here?
Oh, certainly. Certainly to help these countries get themselves back on their feet. I think many of us lament the conditions there, but recognize that the answer is not to simply have open immigration to the United States. It's important to remember that this surge in people coming is because people realize that they can get away with coming here using, you know, smugglers and passing a credible fear test and then disappearing into the woodwork. It's the policy that's driving the influx, not anything the United States has done or should be responsible for. And the reality is that most people are using the claim of asylum as a way to get into the country because they know that friends and family before them have done it also. Half of them don't even submit their asylum application. An even larger number don't really comply with their immigration proceedings. Something like 80% of the people who arrived illegally as families have skipped out on their immigration hearings and know that they're unlikely to face consequences for that, at least under the previous administration. And so we can't allow that kind of really contempt for the due process that they've been offered to continue. And we can't assume that these are all people who are necessarily fleeing for their lives. If they were, they certainly could make an asylum claim in Mexico, which has a robust asylum system and has offered many people coming from Central America the opportunity to apply there.
So Alex, you hear Jessica saying, you know, a lot of people that she sees and hears and knows about, contempt for the due process here. 80% of people who arrive skip out on the immigration hearings. I mean, is that acceptable?
You know, the contempt for the due process here is really on the part of there's a lot of problems with the system here. Most immigration judges are former DHS prosecutors. The contempt, I mean, people don't have attorneys most of the time. There's a huge, I mean, if you commit a crime in the United States and you go to court, you'll get a public defender. If you cross the border and you apply for asylum, you're going to have to represent yourself on your own. You're going to be in an immigrant prison where you will have very little access to communication, poor conditions, poor food. This is, I mean, it's kind of laughable to think that this
using
is
the term prisons
is
really a bit hyperbolic also. I mean, what the government had were family holding centers that were set up for families to be detained until the conclusion of their proceedings. They were could live together, cook together, had activities, playgrounds, recreation, et cetera. It's nothing like a correctional situation whatsoever.
Alan Gomez?
There were some of those, but those are full. And so that's why we hear the Trump administration considering things like military housing to house some of these family units. Last year, they put out a request to increase the number of immigration prisons specifically so that they could house longer term people so that they could try to free up some of these places along the border. So, yeah, somewhere in between.
So, Alan Gomez, I got to go to a break here, but for a long time, illegal immigration in this country was driven by single men from Mexico. That picture has really changed, and I think, has that led to this sort of zero tolerance policy? Has that led to this point where we are now?
We could spend an hour talking about but in short, it's the ones coming from Mexico. That the Mexican immigration has slowed dramatically as their economy has improved and as things have gotten better in that country. In fact, more people are going back to Mexico, according to the Pew Research Center, than coming to the United States. And what we've seen, the increase has come from these Central American countries, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. That's where we're seeing the biggest increases. That's where we're seeing the biggest groups of family units coming, of these miners coming. It's, as we've been debating, whether they're coming here to take advantage of our system or have things gotten that bad in those countries. That's why we're seeing those waves.
We are discussing the Trump administration's new zero-tolerance immigration policy. Alan Gomez, USA Today, Alex Messing from the Pueblo Sin Fronteras Project in California, and Jessica Vaughn from the director of Washington, D.C.-based Center for Immigration Studies. And listeners, we'd love to have you join us. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Planet Money tip number 17. A great analogy doesn't have to make sense.
Busier than a one-legged bobcat covering up his own crap on a frozen pond.
Didn't you just make that up?
Well, yeah. I just...
Planet Money, a poetic podcast about the economy.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking this hour about President Trump's immigration policies and separating families at the border. And you can join the conversation. What's the right thing to do here? Can you be humane and have a secure border? My guest today, Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today, Jessica Vaughn, director of policy studies at the Center for Immigration Studies, and Alex Messing of Pueblo Sin Fronteras. Let's go to the phones. Brian in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I wanted to throw just the international or this cross-border perspective in the pitch. We, too, are receiving vastly more asylum demands from our border, which, of course, is with the United States, because of these tightening procedures. And it sounds like a stretch to say, well, somebody crosses the southern border, finds themselves out of luck and moves on to the north. But we hear very clearly in our news reports that the international movement of people in seeking some relief from what the situations they find intolerable is, in fact, bringing people from as far as Africa, from as far as even the Middle East, to our borders demanding asylum.
So you're saying both borders are suffering, essentially, from this policy, Brian. Thank you very much. Alan Gomez, would you agree with that? Have you seen that in your reporting?
I mean, let's not stop with Canada. I mean, look at what's happening in Europe right now. The debate that we're having has to be done in the context of what is one of the largest migrations in recorded history. I mean, what countries like Germany and Greece and Italy and Turkey, all these are facing with these influxes of people coming from places like Syria, the Middle East, from Africa, places that are struggling with violence, with famine, with all sorts of diseases. It's overwhelming a lot of these countries. And so I can tell you that a lot of places in Europe and also in Canada are looking at the U.S. and saying, at a time that we're reforming a lot of our laws and trying to do what we can to accommodate as many of these refugees as possible, how is it possible that the Nation of Immigrants is kind of closing its borders and trying to restrict as many as possible? Obviously, the Trump administration says that there are national security concerns and basic matters of law that they're trying to address. But we can't have this debate without thinking about what so many other developed countries are going through and trying to accept or trying to figure out how many people to accept.
President Trump tweeted about this zero tolerance policy. He said, quote, "Put pressure on the Democrats to end the horrible law that separates children from their parents once they cross the border into the U.S." Alan Gomez, for the record, just to be clear, did Democrats initiate this?
Democrats did not create these laws. I can run you through several laws, Supreme Court cases and court settlements that have been brokered both by Republicans, Democrats, and again, the Supreme Court, that have set up the system that's currently in place. The problem moving forward is that Congress is loath to consider anything on immigration. We've been seeing this for years, and that is one of the fundamental problems that we face, that while these are all incredibly difficult problems that require nuanced, you know, intelligent solutions. And right now in the House, there are several Republicans who are trying to sign what's called a discharge petition to get four immigration bills onto the House floor just to have a discussion, just to have a debate, to have a vote. House Speaker Paul Ryan is trying to stop that. And so, yeah, we're still sitting here unable to even have a conversation about immigration in Congress.
Jessica Vaughn, just a couple of minutes left here, but you wanted to speak briefly about these quote-unquote lost kids that we made reference to earlier in the program.
Yeah, I think that the attention on the issue of these kids who fall between the cracks and that are not effectively monitored by the federal government after they come into their custody is a real one. And I think the outrage is justified. I think that the advocacy groups are coming a little bit late to the game, that this has been a problem for a couple of years. And the Senate, senators like Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin have been looking into it for years. The system that was set up by the Obama administration to process these kids and prioritize their quick release and has proven to be a disaster, both for some of the kids and for the communities where they've ended up. The Trump administration has finally started to fix that by imposing home studies and more vetting and so on, but only Congress can do this. And I'm not sure that the solutions that are being pushed by people through this discharge position are going to address this. Only one proposal before Congress now would really be an effective solution, which is the Securing America's Future Act introduced by Bob Goodlatte from Virginia.
Alex Messing, I've got 30 seconds left here, but I want to give you the last word. You're on the ground. You're right in the middle of it. What do you want us to remember from this conversation?
I think it's important to remember that the people who leave Central America, they don't know how U.S. immigration policy works. They're not just coming because they think that something particular is going to happen to them. They were terrified of the idea that they would be separated from their children, which they knew. We told them this on the caravan, and they crossed anyways because they're fleeing for their lives. They'll do whatever they can to save their children. And I think that the entire problem of what to do with the children would be solved by not taking them away from their parents.
Difficult problem. We've heard compelling arguments on both sides today, and I appreciate this great panel. Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today. Alan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Alex Messing of Pueblo Sin Fronteras. Thank you, Alex.
Thanks, everyone.
And Jessica Vaughn, director of policy studies at the Center for Immigration Studies. Great to have you with me here.
Thanks, Jane.
In a moment, listeners, Roseanne Bard from ABC. This is On Point. After an enormously successful reboot of the 90s sitcom Roseanne, ABC abruptly canceled the show yesterday. The news came after its star, Roseanne Barr, sent out racist and conspiracy theory-laden tweets. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Lorraine Alley, television critic for the Los Angeles Times. Lorraine, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And from Washington, Jane Costin, senior politics reporter at Vox. Welcome back to you, Jane.
Hi, Jane. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you. Lorraine, let me start with you. 2 months ago, Roseanne Barr's sitcom returned to ABC. It'd been 2 decades since she was there. She was a star again, a huge win for the network. And then she had this kind of lapse, I guess, although there's a history of this kind of dialogue with her. This was a huge gamble, and it didn't quite pay off for ABC. Give us the history here.
Well, I mean, that's right. You know, the show came back after, you know, 20 years and was a huge hit for ABC and across television. But, you know, this tweet took that down in a matter of hours. And you're right. I mean, Roseanne Barr is, you know, no stranger to controversy over the years, whether it was mangling the national anthem, dressing up like Hitler, you know, various tweets, a similar tweet like this about another African-American Obama aide. So she's had this in the past. And I think this time it's astounding the speed at which it just completely took her down and the show. And Roseanne, the show, is no longer after having this amazing, successful comeback. Mm.
Jane, President Trump wrapped his arms around Roseanne. A lot of people tuned into his speech last night to hear what he might say about all this, because he's been very vocal about her and her show and her success. What did you hear in the president's silence last night?
Well, I think that the president made a pretty smart decision, I would say, probably with a fair amount of involvement from White House staff, because I think that, you know, there's been a lot of talk on Twitter, but this is not the hill upon which President Trump wants to die. I think that Roseanne's past on Twitter, which I kind of storied for Vox yesterday, has been one of talking about Jewish mind control and saying Israel is a Nazi state, but then also saying that, you know, just a series of really unhinged comments about conspiracy theories or Pizzagate or, you know, hoping that all the Jews leave UC Davis and then it gets nuked. You know, she ran for president as part of a far left fringe political party. She believes that the Boston Marathon bombings were a false flag operation. Like, this was not, you know, this is something, one, ABC should have known better than to get involved again with Roseanne, as even though she was so successful in the first iteration, Roseanne. But I do think that there's very much a sense for Trump that this wasn't worth it to, you know, to say something on.
Here is President Trump during a March speech in Ohio. He said he called Roseanne to congratulate her on the rebooted show's success and her ratings.
They were unbelievable. Over 18 million people. And it was about us. They haven't figured it out. The fake news hasn't quite figured it out yet. They have not figured it out. So that was great.
Well, the show is no more. ABC's network president said Barr's tweet was, quote, abhorrent, repugnant, and inconsistent with our values. Should note that the president of ABC Entertainment is a black woman. This decision, Lorraine Ali, was swift and bold.
It really was. I mean, if you consider, you know, once again, the popularity of the show and also, you know, what the show represented. There aren't really a lot of series, you know, comedies or dramas on right now that represent the white middle class and also have a Trump voter as the, you know, lead character, which Roseanne Conner, you know, the star of Roseanne, was. So you kind of take away that perspective, and that perspective is pretty important to have right now to at least even push back against or to represent. And so it really was a bold choice, and it went down in a matter of minutes, not minutes, but hours. You know, that tweet was what, how many seconds?
Mm-hmm.
But Roseanne has since said, you know, Roseanne Barr has since said, well, you know, I was Ambien tweeting, you know.
Right. She blamed Ambien, the sleep drug.
Yeah, she did.
Yeah.
You know, and while she apologized for the tweet, you know, that the whole thing about, oh, it was Ambien, oh, I'm being attacked in a way that other comedians aren't, it's not exactly an apology. It's an apology for the tweet, but kind of like not an apology for her history of bad behavior.
In response to that apology blaming Ambien, from Roseanne Barr, this is a tweet from the makers of Ambien, who said, people of all races, religions, and nationalities work at Santa Fe every day to improve the lives of people around the world. While all pharmaceutical treatments have side effects, racism is not a known side effect of any Santa Fe medication.
Wow.
I want to play this clip. This is a former Obama advisor, Valerie Jarrett, speaking with MSNBC. Of course, she was the at the end of Roseanne Barr's tweet, the target of it. Here's Valerie Jarrett speaking yesterday about that offensive tweet. It's a teaching moment, she says, and an opportunity to make progress on race relations.
I'm fine. I'm worried about all the people out there who don't have a circle of friends and followers who come right to their defense. The person who's walking down the street minding their own business and they see somebody cling to their purse or want to cross the street. Or every black parent I know who has a boy who has to sit down and have a conversation, the talk, as we call it.
Jane Costin, your response, your thoughts about Valerie Jarrett's reaction there.
Well, I think it was a smart reaction, but I also think that, you know, this isn't the first time Roseanne has tweeted racist bromides about Obama officials. You know, in 2013,
Susan Rice
is a man with I won't continue the tweet.
Mm-hmm.
But, there's a history here. And it's interesting to me that Valerie Jarrett, the subject of this racism, or the object, more appropriately, is the person who needs to be the adult here, whereas the, well-known, long-famous actress who should be experienced at conducting herself in public is not expected to. She's the one who's making excuses about Ambien tweeting.
And yet, Lorraine Ali, there are plenty of Roseanne Barr supporters out there who say there is a double standard here. They point to people like Bill Maher, who made a comment on The Tonight Show in 2013 comparing Donald Trump to an orangutan, joking that he wanted proof that Trump wasn't related to an ape. Bill Maher's show wasn't canceled. I mean, is there a double standard here on some level?
Right. I mean, this whole wave of Roseanne defenders is there. I mean, look, I think you have to look at this historically the way that, we're talking about her using a terminology that has been used as a racist way to look at African Americans. Now, Bill Maher, has said plenty of things that I, as a Muslim, take offense to and that I think are very bigoted. I do not think the orangutan comment about Trump is that. I think that comes from someplace else. And I think that's a false equivalency on the part of her defenders. But there certainly are other comedians that, of course, are, even probably more egregious.
Mm-hmm.
But are they at the level of success of Roseanne Barr? No.
Mm-hmm. Jane Costin, she certainly did walk a tightrope between red state, blue state debates. And Lorraine mentioned earlier, sort of what we're missing with this character now on TV. How do you see that from a sort of political, larger cultural perspective?
Well, I think that, there's a lot of good television that is talking to people who, haven't felt represented on television. I'm thinking of, It Just Ended, but the show The Middle, or Jane the Virgin, or something like that. But, the idea that Roseanne Barr was the same person as Roseanne on the show, I watched the original iteration of Roseanne, which was actually pretty left-leaning, talking about sex and drugs and same-sex relationships on television at a time when the only show really able to do that was The Golden Girls, unexpectedly. But, Roseanne Barr is not that person. The Roseanne Barr is the same person who, nearly ran for president alongside Jill Stein. Roseanne Barr is the person who who performed the national anthem so awfully on purpose
mm-hmm.
that then President George H.W. Bush called her performance disgraceful.
Right.
And I feel as if to tie Roseanne Barr, the person, to, this is what middle America or this is what Trump support of America wants is to kind of, I think that's kind of denigrates Trump supporters and middle America. Middle America largely does not think that Goldman Sachs should be executed or think that, that no Jew can truly speak as a Jew. No Jew can really speak anywhere. And these are all tweets of Roseanne Barr. I think that it's important to recognize that Roseanne and Roseanne Barr are not the same person.
Well, ABC and by extension Disney put their stake in the ground saying words matter. Lorraine Ali, television critic for the Los Angeles Times, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Jane Costin, senior political reporter at Vox. Jane, thank you.
Thank you.
Continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.